is showing affection, kindness, and consideration towards people. This is dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When it comes to the analysis of the life of the Imam, one begins to understand that there were a number of challenges that were posed in his lifetime. What kind of challenges? He went through 5 Abbasid caliphs. Who were they? As-Saffah, Al-Mansur, Al-Hadi, Al-Mahdi, and finally Harun al-Abbasi. And during each and every caliphate of these particular 5 tyrants, the Imam Salamullahi Alayhi adopted a number of strategies and became very much influential within the community and within the Muslim Ummah. One thing that the Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim, Salawatullahi wa Salamu Alayhi, was very much distinguished at the onset was the fact that he wanted to purify the intentions as well as correct some of the moral indecencies that were prevalent within the society at that time. In which way? Imam alayhi salam would walk past a house in which music is being played. A servant outside is bringing the rubbish or the garbage. He asks her, the owner of the house that the music inside is being played, is he a slave or is he a master? She responds back by saying, indeed, he is a master. Imam alayhi salam would say to her, if he was a slave, he would have respected his master. And he moves on. The lady goes back. The man inside by the name of Bishr says to her, who did you speak to? She describes this man that she saw. She says he has thafanat. Thafanat means excess skin on his forehead. She says to him that he was so skinny when he was standing, I could see the wind somewhat moving his body and his aba. He immediately recognizes that this is a noble individual, a virtuous man. Tell me, what is it that he said? She responds back by saying that he said, if the man inside the house was a slave, he would have respected his master. That statement hit hard in the heart of this man, Bishr, who runs barefooted to catch Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and says to him, Sayyidi wa Mawlai, halli min tawba.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The city of Severodonetsk lies mostly in ruins.
It was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting between the two armies. It now resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. At a military base, a pro-Russian fighter pulls down a Ukrainian sign. What's left of the city is now in Russian hands. On the outskirts of town, a grain silo. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for bombing it.
Now, that may well be one of the most tragic places that I've been to in this war, because millions of people around the world may well go hungry due to this conflict because of the huge amounts of grain that Ukraine exports in usual times around the world. For those people, it won't really matter whether it was Russia or Ukraine who committed this strike.
Humanity is bombing its own food supplies. Unsurprisingly, few people remain in the city. Those that do are keen to tell of what they saw.
The Ukrainians knew where people lived. They drove around looking for people's houses. And when they fled, they occupied their houses and started firing. We live in that house, and they were firing from there for 3 weeks.
It wasn't all done by Russia. It was done by Ukraine. There are witnesses who saw tanks driving up and firing at houses, just like that.
While NATO and Ukraine blame Russia for the devastation, the strange truth is that everyone I spoke to here is more critical of Ukraine.
Ukraine acted in a sly way. They would bring a howitzer here, fire, and then leave. Then Russia would strike, and they would say Russia is bombing civilians. They were occupying kindergartens and would fire from there.
They made them sit in the basement and took over their flats. They put mortars on the roofs and fired. We don't know what Russia did. We didn't see them until we returned.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other for the devastation wrought by this conflict, there remains little appetite for peace. The longer this war goes on, the more of Ukraine will be destroyed, and the greater the threat to world food supplies and the global economy. Jaromír Severodonetsk.
EU Foreign Affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, there might be a problem, and then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialize.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British capital is boiling with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing. Every year, it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, that's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg Climate Dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Saeed Purizap, London.
Mashhad, a tourist magnet in northeast Iran. Every year, some 30 million pilgrims from across the Muslim world travel to Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. But a few miles away from the shrine, there's a whole new world for tourists who would also like to enjoy natural resorts after a spiritual journey. Welcome to Kuh Sangi, a heaven at the heart of Mashhad, as described by this Iraqi family.
We come from Iraq. We visited the holy shrine of Imam Reza, and then I found about this amazing place called Kuh Sangi and came with my family to enjoy the scenery.
It's my second trip to Mashhad. The city offers you a whole traveling package that includes pilgrimage and recreation.
Kuh Sangi is one of a myriad of attractions in Mashhad. Natural resorts such as Shandiz and Chali Dara Valley, and recreational centers such as Water Waves Land and Iram Amusement Park are among the must-see places in Mashhad. The city is also home to 10,000 historical sites. Only 1,500 of those sites have so far been registered and developed for tourists.
One of the major attractions of Mashhad is its restaurants and street eateries. Mashhad is the city of foods. It has numerous restaurants serving a variety of local and international foods. Mashhad also has more than 680 parks, providing a chance for visitors to entertain themselves besides their pilgrimage.
Mashhad is also a hotspot for health tourism in the region. Only in 2021, over 24,000 health tourists visited the city, mainly from Iraq and Oman, earning the city roughly $48 million. Authorities in Mashhad say the potentials are countless, but so are the challenges. To foreign visitors, Mashhad is still a religious-only city, and many are not aware of its recreational capacities.
We at the municipality are trying to raise awareness of the attractions in Mashhad. One of those efforts is the launching of the English version of our website, which guides foreign travelers through the city online. We will soon launch the Arabic webpage as well.
Due to the large number of visitors throughout the year, Mashhad has one of the best-equipped public transport systems in the country. It has a growing subway network and bus rapid transit system, beside other transportation services, making it easy to access the desired tourist destinations in the city.
Known as the spiritual capital of Iran, Mashhad seems to offer more than a spiritual experience to visitors. With its spectacular natural resorts and growing number of recreational centers, Mashhad municipality plans to turn the city into a tourist hub in the region. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Mashhad.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue the changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place. The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains. Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn. People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that 22% of people in the EU are struggling to make ends meet. That's almost 100 million citizens who are counting every cent. Apparently, sending weapons to Ukraine is not the answer.
The best way to deal with the cost of living crisis is to stop prolonging the war. The people of Europe favour peace, even well above punishing Russia.
EU financial markets are in turmoil. There are calls for the introduction of a windfall tax.
Energy prices and food prices are going through the roof. Capitalists make profits by speculating on markets and thereby hurting millions of households.
Members of the public have been talking to us about the current state of the EU's economy.
It's terrifying to see that our free market is like collapsing. All the money that we are going to send to Ukraine, then we will have to need this money, and where we are going to take this money from.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has been singled out for criticism in the European Parliament.
We talk now about the increase of cost of living in the European Union, which is just a result of the insane and unsound policies promoted by the European Union since Ursula von der Leyen took office.
There have been calls for greater solidarity between EU member states to deal with the cost of living crisis.
In order to make sure that we are not at the end dividing Europe in those who are able to help and those who have more difficulties.
On sanctions against Russia, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "Initially I thought that we had only shot ourselves in the foot, but now it is clear that the EU economy has shot itself in the lungs and is gasping for air." Many here agree. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Despite the UN brokered truce, the consequences of the Saudi-led war are still taking the lives of Yemeni women and children. A recent report by the International Committee of the Red Cross says a mother and six newborns die every 2 hours in Yemen of complications that occur during pregnancy and causes that can be avoided in normal circumstances.
There is a severe shortage of medical supplies and medicines, as well as a significant increase in the prices of medicines, which has led to the deterioration of health services not only in the countryside, but even in main cities.
We as gynecologists have noticed a significant increase in the number of abortions, especially premature abortions in the early stages of pregnancy. Therefore, we hope to conduct studies that will reveal to us the reason and whether or not the prohibited weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition contributed to this tragedy.
The committee says the numbers are likely to increase due to a lack of health services or poor care provided, especially amid a shortage of funding for the United Nations programs in Yemen, as well as the termination of aid related to reproductive health and mother and child health. Recently, most of the United Nations programs, including the World Food Programme, announced the suspension of their humanitarian activities in Yemen due to a lack of funding, as well as the consequences of the Russia-Ukraine war.
Yemeni health officials say 19 million Yemenis lack access to health care. They say it is a shame for the international community to abandon Yemeni women and the children who have been paying the highest price since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue that changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place.
The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains.
Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn.
I know that more than 90% of corona can be prevented by wearing a mask, but if people keep coming inside and taking off their masks, I feel like it will be impossible to stop the spread. So the government should take stronger measures in that area.
People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Every year in the lunar month of Dhul Hijjah, Muslims celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, a major festivity on the Islamic calendar, marking the day when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia imam, as his successor, and Muslims' next leader some 14 centuries ago. In Iran's city of Mashhad, the shrine of Imam Reza has been hosting pilgrims who have come days ahead of the auspicious occasion to celebrate the festivity.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all fellow Muslims. I come from Iraq to participate in the celebrations here in Mashhad. Eid al-Ghadir marks the day when Prophet Muhammad announced to Muslims that Imam Ali is the next Muslim leader. He raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever I am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Eid al-Ghadir comes 8 days after another major festivity on the Islamic lunar calendar, dubbed Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. The occasion marks the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
To us Iranians, it's a blessing to visit the shrine of Imam Reza on the Feast of Sacrifice and other festivities. Those of us who can't make it to Mecca on the Hajj usually come to Imam Reza's shrine to pray and enjoy the spiritual atmosphere.
Imam Reza is the eighth Shia imam, whose bloodline goes back to the Prophet of Islam. He holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years of life in Iran, away from his birthplace in modern-day Saudi Arabia. Every year, his holy shrine hosts millions of pilgrims from around the Muslim world, especially during religious occasions. Iranians never miss a chance to come and visit the shrine of Imam Reza. And now that Eid al-Ghadir is just around the corner, Shia Muslims find it an opportunity to once again attend this holy site and share the festive mood with each other. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Everyone is invited to this party that stretches for 10 kilometers in Tehran. As Shia Muslims around the world are marking Eid al-Ghadir, Iranians have got together in this festival to share the happy mood with each other.
This beautiful celebration has drawn many Iranians to enjoy Eid al-Ghadir festivity together. I congratulate all my fellow Muslims on the Eid.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all Muslims. We Shia Muslims
regard this festivity as a chance to renew our allegiance with Imam Ali, our first Imam.
Eid al-Ghadir marks the beginning of Shia Islam some 14 centuries ago, when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia Imam, as his successor and Muslims' next leader.
On Eid al-Ghadir, Prophet Muhammad raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Imam Ali was the cousin of Prophet Muhammad and is known as the first man to embrace the Prophet's call for Islam. According to Islamic references, Imam Ali rooted out poverty and promoted an unprecedented justice system across the Muslim world during his short rule, based in Iraq's city of Kufa.
Imam Ali represents justice, humanity, and chivalry. During his rule, he eliminated sexual and racial discrimination and promoted kindness.
Here, not only do Iranians celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, they get to teach their kids about who Imam Ali was.
I named my son after Imam Ali. It's not just about his name. I like him to act and behave like Imam Ali. That's why I brought him to this ceremony. Imam Ali is a role model for all of us.
In Shia Islam, there are 12 imams or religious leaders, all believed to have preserved the legacy of the Prophet. Mahdi is the last imam, who is believed to be the apocalyptic savior of the world, and is currently living in occultation.
To Muslims, Eid al-Ghadir is a time when God perfected their religion by introducing Imam Ali as their next leader. That's why they celebrate it every year, to honor Imam Ali as the father of Shia Islam, a symbol of Islamic justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Paul Ruiz, an educator in San Antonio, Texas, said the way the Uvalde massacre has been handled is part of a long history of delegitimizing Hispanic people in this part of Texas. We now present you an article written by Charlie Scudder. The piece is titled, "Not Good Enough, Uvalde Victims' Families React to Report on U.S. Police Failures." Wearing a shirt bearing his granddaughter's name and a button with her face, Vincent Salazar arrived at the Uvalde Civic Center around noon on Sunday, 17th of July, to learn what a Texas legislative committee had determined about the day she died. He didn't expect answers to his most pressing questions, like exactly how it happened and who was accountable for not preventing the tragedy, but still wanted to be there for Layla, the 10-year-old girl who loved to swim and run before the day a gunman walked into a fourth-grade classroom in May. "The morning," Salazar said, "I feel like this every day, every single day. The report doesn't change anything." The committee had prepared a 77-page report that detailed failure after failure from the authorities during the 24th of May attack. All morning on Sunday, 17th of July, relatives trickled in to the small South Texas city to pick up their copy. Among those conclusions, red flags about the gunman prior to the attack went unreported or ignored by friends and family. Doors that should have been locked were unlocked. Poor Wi-Fi kept some teachers from getting emergency alerts. Police officers from multiple agencies failed to confront the gunman for 73 minutes. Relatives of victims, like Salazar, said they can't trust the findings of investigations done behind closed doors. The committee's chairman, state representative, and Lubbock Republican Dustin Burrows said the report was a small step forward, a shared set of facts. There will be more reports after the deadliest school shooting in the state's history. Dustin Burrows said on Sunday there were multiple systemic failures, adding that other state house committees could do more to investigate who is to blame for some of those failures. He said, "That is not what we were tasked with in this report." That lack of accountability and trust in the authorities in the town of around 16,000 people made Salazar skeptical. He said, "I'll tell you right now, it's not the truth," adding, "It's a joke. Texas failed those children." While a steady stream of families came to pick up copies of the report, others from all over Texas visited the makeshift memorial outside Robb Elementary School in Uvalde. After 2 months in the heat of a brutal Texas summer, the memorial outside has started to change. The fur on the teddy bears has become matted and grey. After weeks of 100 degree Fahrenheit heat, prayer candles have melted. Hundreds of bouquets stacked up have wilted, giving a scent of dried rose petal in the dusty schoolyard. Layers of toys, letters, hard-drawn posters and other mementos are stacked nearly 4 feet high in front of 21 white crosses, informally marking the killings of the 19 young children and 2 teachers. Individual victims have their own references. The father and stepmother of Yuzia Sergio Garcia, a 10-year-old who died at the school, live in San Angelo, Texas, and were in town on Sunday to see a mural honoring him. When they heard about the newly released report, they drove to the Civic Center. Crystal Garcia, Yuzia's stepmother, hoped it would provide some kind of clarity into what happened on that day. Garcia told The Guardian, "I hope it does. I hope it does. It's difficult not having the answers you want, the answers that you need." Yuzia's great aunt, Grace Valencia, pulled out her phone and began to flip through photographs of the young boy, saying they'd been due to go on holiday together to a popular water park that weekend. At a press conference on Sunday evening, 17th of July, many families wanted to know why the report's authors had not laid blame. They wanted accountability. They wanted action. But because the committee prioritized questions from the media, none of the community members at the meeting were able to ask their questions. When the committee's press liaison ended the meeting, the room erupted in shouts and jeers. Tina Quintanilla Taylor, whose daughter survived the shooting, shouted, "You kept us waiting, just like you kept those kids waiting, and you're not going to answer our questions." As the committee left the Civic Center, Daniel Myers, a local pastor, yelled, "Bunch of cowards. The people have a right to ask questions." Paul Ruiz, an educator in San Antonio, Texas, said, "The way the massacre had been handled is part of a long history of delegitimizing Hispanic people in this part of Texas." He pointed to lynchings and segregation efforts in the 20th century and said, "Continued inequities in the region are key to understanding the Uvalde tragedy." He also criticized the committee for not recommending any action on gun control in the state. Using an expletive, Ruiz said, "These people can identify the height of the fence, but they never point to the militaristic weapon that killed 21 people. This is systemic to Texas. Among those family members with questions was Jesse Rizzo, whose brother was related to Jackie Cazares, a 9-year-old who died at the school. Jesse Rizzo said, "She knew me as her tío, her uncle," adding, "It's disheartening. These families, they're looking for closure. It's just going to drag on." Even with his low expectations, Vincent Salazar said he was upset after reading it with how little the committee did to provide accountability for the massacre that killed his granddaughter. Salazar said, "I didn't tell you nothing. This whole thing is a joke. It's not good enough for me. It's not good enough for my granddaughter." The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, issued a statement on Monday, 18th of July, saying the report's findings are beyond disturbing and raise serious concerns, and pledging change. A committee of state lawmakers investigating the massacre has found there were systemic failures and egregious poor decision-making involved in the deadly school shooting at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde. The 77-page report from the Texas legislature details glaring failures in the years leading up to and during the 24th of May shooting. According to a report, nearly 400 law enforcement officers from myriad agencies went to the school after the killing started, but they were stymied by a lack of coordination. Law enforcement officers told investigators they assumed Uvalde School District Police Chief Pete Arredondo was in charge at the scene. But Arredondo has said publicly he did not believe himself to be in charge. Law enforcement waited more than an hour before eventually confronting and killing the shooter. The report details how a police officer with the State Department of Public Safety at one point confronted officers who were clustered together in the hall and heard another officer asking if there were kids in the classroom. He said, "If there's kids in there, we need to go in there now." Another officer responded, "Whoever was in charge would figure that out." While Pete Arredondo has resigned a city council seat and been placed on leave from his chief's job amid heavy scrutiny for the inadequate law enforcement response, the report also faults other law enforcement agencies for not stepping up to fill the void. Investigators concluded having a clear commander outside the schools could have helped end the deadly incident faster by figuring out a better way to communicate and charting a path for law enforcement to breach the classroom where the shooter was. For decades, U.S. police have been trained to confront so-called active shooters as quickly as possible, with police officers expected to organize themselves for that fight regardless of the agency employing them if there's even a remote chance to save some lives.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars, dignitaries, and ulama all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within this series are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Dr. Fakhr Rouhani. Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The personality with whom we are mainly concerned for today's discussion is a lady, we can say it's called a lady, Sayyidin Nusrat Begum Amin, mainly known as Sayyidin Nusrat Amin, a very outstanding dignitary, an outstanding arif, mufassir, we can say, and faqiha. Among the ladies of the Shiite world. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Sayyidina Nusrat Begum Amin.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyidina Nusrat Begum Amin is one of the religious women and also a scholar women of Shia who is born in 1247, according to lunar calendar, in one of the cities of Isfahan. She is born to a rich family whose father was a merchant called Amin al-Tujjar, and also whose mother was a religious mother. And also he benefited from the great ulama. Actually, she started her study while she was 5 years old, yes, going to the Maktab Khane, before having these schools in their modern type. They would send their children, I mean the families would send their children to the place which is called Maktab Khane.
And usually in Maktab Khane, they were busy with learning Quran, Hadith, yes, and Arabic alphabetic or alphabets.
And also Farsi literature.
Farsi literature.
Yes, Farsi right. literature, okay. What right now we are missing in our generation. Yes,
okay.
So she started her study while she was 5 years old. And when she was almost 11 years old, she started officially to study religious lessons. And when she reaches 40 years, she gets the permission of ijtihad from the great ulama of her time.
Okay.
And very surprisingly, we have the name of the great and outstanding ulama from among those who got permission of riwayah from her. This is very... this is very strange.
I mean, she gave permission to the great ulama.
Yes,
like Allama Amini, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi,
yes,
and
these
others.
Two are the most commended our listeners
Was it common among the ladies to get the permission of ijtihad or hadith? Or, for example, about the religious studies, it is known. But about the high levels, advanced levels of studies, was it common something on that time or not?
To be honest, it was not that common, but it was not a kind of topic that you can marginalize and overlook it. Uh-huh. Because we have a books, voluminous book like Rayahin al-Sharia,
yes,
which has been written in regards to collection or categorization of the all scholars among the women.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
and
right.
When we look at her name, we see this honorific title, Begum.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, which is given to the great women.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right. The great, highest status women. That's all right. Okay. Dr. Fakhwani, give us some details about the scholar life of Banu Amin. She's also known as Banu Amin or Banu Irani, okay?
Yeah.
These are the titles that are given to her, but mainly known as Sayyidina Nusrat Amin, the Faqiha. Give us some details about her scholar life.
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin istain. It's an honor for me to be here in such a session devoted to a great lady.
Yes.
A great Shia lady who devoted her life,
yes,
to Islamic religious studies. True. First and foremost, I should like to say that a couple of years ago, I was lucky to find out one of the works of Banu Amin Isfahani.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started reading the book, I got surprised at the profundity of the discussions available in the book.
Oh.
It was about Shia history and Shia doctrinal topics.
Yes.
All in all, I should like to say that what's surprising in this regard is that Banu Amin Isfahani or Banu Nusrat Amin Isfahani,
yes,
I mean, she's got various designations.
Yes.
What's important is that She started learning Islamic studies and making a professional figure in this regard when it wasn't that common for ladies, yes. I mean for girls and ladies, to go to schools in order yes. to learn something. However, I mean, contrary to the currents of the changes available at that time, and particularly in such a time that, because it was, in the time of Reza Khan,
yes.
and Reza Khan was, very much intent to close religious schools and to open, European-style schools. Yes. However, instead of attending European-like schools, Banu Amin Isfahani preferred to go to Islamic schools, and this is very surprising. Okay? Yes. At the same time, it must be indicated that one of the outstanding works of this great lady is Quran exegesis
yes.
in 15 volumes.
Yes.
And it was a kind of argumentative
yes.
and, well-reasoned book,
yes.
And especially, packed with doctrinal and hadith-oriented discussions.
That's right.
It's called Mahzan al-Irfan.
Yes, yes, Mahzan al-Irfan.
Yeah, Mahzan al-Irfan.
Yes, that's right.
Another one is Al-Arab'in al-Hashimiyya fi sharh jumlat min al-ahadith al-warda fi al-ulum al-diniyya. This book is about, Islamic studies, and it's about, as the title suggests, it's about, 40 hadiths selected,
yes.
From amongst the, a vast number of hadiths. Another one is, a book that she devoted to Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, Mahzan al-Li'ali,
yes.
Dar Fazilat Mawla Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. This is, this book, shows that she was a real devotee of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam.
That's right.
The other books of hers are about, doctrinal topics or, generally speaking, Islamic moralities and
That's
Islamic
right.
ethical topics and discussions.
But she's known with Mahzan al, we can say, Irfan.
Yes.
In exegesis of the Holy Quran.
Yes.
We'll get to that details. But the great point about her life is giving ijazah to, outstanding scholars like Ayatollah Marashi, Ayatollah Amini. Technically speaking, the fuqaha and the maraje, are they allowed to get permission from a lady in Islam or not? Is it so?
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Maybe we
have a kind of misunderstanding uh-huh. regarding the position of ijtihad or marja'i taqlid to be given to the women.
Uh-huh.
So what we have in the Sharia is that women cannot assume the position of marja'i taqlid, sitting at that position and giving and issuing the fatwa, and for some people to follow her mm-hmm. as their marja'i taqlid. But reaching the level of ijtihad is something far different from becoming a marja'i taqlid.
Okay.
Someone might reach the level of ijtihad while she or he is not marja'i taqlid.
That's right.
So this misunderstanding maybe is coming from the propaganda against us that always Muslim women will be suppressed and their right will be taken away. But when we look at the position of Lady Banu Amin
mm-hmm.
and the respect that she received from the great ulama, that we had some of the poetry in condolence on her demise by some of the great ulama, that being female
yes.
for the Shams is oh. not going to give any shortcoming.
Yes.
Because we know the word Shams in Arabic is treated as a female word.
Female one, that's right.
What we have, our listeners are familiar. In English also, we differentiate between he and she.
Yes.
There are some words that will be treated as masculine
and feminine.
That's
right.
Feminine. But in that poetry, that great alim is saying that being female is not giving any shortcoming
yes.
to the Shams
yes.
or to the sun. And also being male is not giving
mm-hmm.
any advantage to the Qamar or the moon. And
right.
then he gets to the part of the,
That's right.
Which is in concern with
yes.
her position.
That's right.
He's saying that while you are a woman, but you are standing at that high position,
level.
That many of the ulama got the permission of Rawaya and Ishrat from you.
Yes.
And she actually cultivated and brought up a
yes.
lot of students.
Also, spiritually and mystically speaking, she has been the teacher and trainer of so many outstanding spiritual trainers. And this is also outstanding about Sayyidina Nusrat Amin. Murtaza Mutahari, Shahid Murtaza Mutahari, also says that when I was in her presence, I asked a simple question, and when she started answering, on that moment I understood that what a great personality is she, how a scholar is she, to answer me with so much, you know, power, you can say, based on the knowledge. And this is really, we can say, outstanding about Sayyida Nusrat Amin and the other ladies who are, as you said, by a wrong picture, which is given out of the, we can say, Islamic seminaries or something like that, that they do not welcome the women. The women and the Scout women are welcomed very much. As we said, socially and culturally speaking, she was very much active, especially in the case of hijab, isn't it? In the period of Reza Khan.
Yes.
What was the exact story, Dr. Fah?
Actually, as you know, in the time of Reza Khan, it must be first and foremost indicated that initially Reza Khan wasn't an educated person. He was an illiterate person.
Yes.
And based on authentic historical records available, it spoke that he was deliberately chosen for this purpose.
Yes.
Because an illiterate person is like a blind person. Okay, mm-hmm. Whatever you say to him, okay, he's supposed to obey. Okay?
Yes, okay.
And Reza Khan thought that, okay, opposing hijab or other Islamic rules would bring... for example, progress to the whole country, while it isn't the case, because, Islamic religion is never against, making progress in whatever field might be.
Yes, okay.
At that time, Reza Khan started opposing both, wearing hijab and the Goharshad Mosque in Mashhad, the episode over there, the massacre over committed over there is a good proof in this regard, first and foremost. Again, side by side with this, Reza Khan initiated, giving priority to Western-style schools in the nation.
Okay.
And it must be indicated that it wasn't the sagacity of Reza Khan to introduce Western-style schools because he was altogether against scholarship, against knowledge,
yes,
altogether.
Okay.
However, in order to oppose Reza Khan, various religious people adopted various policies. Mm-hmm. For example, the Iranian ulama who were in Najaf, okay, started attracting, some people from Iran and attracting them. They attracted them to Najaf in order to educate them as, clerics.
Yes.
Because Najaf was away from the, radius of Reza Khan's influence.
Yes. Okay.
But inside Iran, Banu Nusrat Isfahani started, opening an Islamic school, an Islamic madrasa or college. Not that very much, widely famous,
yes.
But, she made school at home,
okay.
And, she started, admitting students and started, educating them. In this way, it must be indicated that amongst the top-ranking women, religious women who opposed Reza Khan, not politically or, for example, in a military mode, but rather in a cultural
aspect,
in a scholarly way, was Banu Nusrat Isfahani. But at the same time, let me make a slight contribution. There's a book entitled Muhaddasat Shia. I think this book hasn't been translated into English, but I've read its Persian original.
Okay.
Muhaddasat Shia, it means the Shia ladies who transmitted hadith, generation by generation.
Or the female transmitters of hadith.
Yes,
right.
Female transmitters of hadith,
yes.
Written by Dr. Nahla Gharavi Naini, who is at the moment professor of Islamic studies at Harbi Modarris University in Tehran.
Yes. Okay.
If you refer to this book, if our audience refer to this book, they would find that throughout the Shia history, right from the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam up to now, there have been a large number of female transmitters of hadith,
okay.
And the most important transmitter of hadith, female transmitter of hadith, in the whole Islamic history, was Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha.
That's all,
yes.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
Welcome.
But Banu Nusrat Amin composed an outstanding, voluminous exegesis of the Holy Quran, Makhzanul Irfan calls it, in fact, it's better to say the treasure of mystic or mysticism or something like that, Irfan. What is this book exactly? It must be very difficult, especially for a lady, have an exegesis on the Holy Quran in 15 volumes and giving it argumentative analysis on the Holy Quran, isn't it, Sheikh Matavi?
Yes, it is really difficult, specifically if you consider that you are married and you are a woman, you are not a man,
what mm-hmm. we are familiar with is that women are working at home and they yes. will provide some time for men to become great ulama. Yes. But now we are looking at this picture and we see a vice versa.
Okay.
Because she got married while she was 15 years old and she delivered 8 children.
Wow.
Out of really? Which 7 died because of the diseases
the pandemics.
At that time. Yes.
Okay.
But when we look at her lifestyle, we will understand that the achievement that she obtained was out of the grace of Allah and her hard working. For example, right. before we get into the topic of Mahsan al-Irfan, her outstanding work, we have to know that she was mostly staying at home and great ulama would come and teach her. So it is narrated that Sayyid Ali Najaf Abadi, who was her great ustad or teacher after the demise of 2 of her children, he didn't go to her house. He was thinking that she may not be concerned anymore with these things and lessons. But after 2 days, she sent someone after the teacher to come and teach me.
Yes.
And it shows her concern. And now we see such fruits out of her yes. hardworking, like Mahsan al-Irfan, a voluminous book on the Quran. Actually, it's commentary on the Quran,
That's
as you
right.
mentioned, 15 volumes.
Yes.
And she mentions as her incentive or motive that pushed her to start writing this commentary on the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
She says that I was thinking if possible to collect a simple words of Ahlul Bayt regarding the Quran or commentary on the mm-hmm. Quran. Then that thought and intention pushed me forward to start this work. And alhamdulillah, I succeeded.
Yes.
And I managed to have the entire completion of the commentary on Quran in 15 volumes. And when you look at the type of her commentary, you see, as Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, it's really well reasoned and has much to do with rationality.
That's all
because
right.
of her hard working and
right.
Concentration on philosophy and
That's
mysticism
right. yes. Very
alongside
good.
The riwayat and the
yes.
hadith.
And you said writing an argumentative, you know, exists on the Holy Quran seems to be very much rational based, and this is something done by a Muslim Shia lady, we
yeah.
can say, in the whole Islamic world, which made her an exception, I think, in the whole Shia, we can say, in the Muslim communities, especially in contemporary era. Thank you much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, for your presence in the program. The teacher talking about Sayyid Nusrat Begum Amin, one of the most outstanding Shia scholars and exegetes of the Holy Quran. She passed away on Sha'ban 30, 1403, according to the lunar Hijri calendar, in the city of Isfahan, and she was buried in Takht-e-Fulat Cemetery, which is the burial place of so many outstanding scholars and ulama of the Shiite world. This is really one of the precious grave sites of the whole Muslim land. So many outstanding scholars, ulamas, we can say from both sides, the ladies, men, and gentlemen are buried over there. And may our dear listeners find a chance to pay a visit to the city of Isfahan, its outstanding places, and also Takht-e-Fulat Cemetery. It was very kind of you, Dr. Fakhr and Sheikh Mahtavi.
Most
thank
welcome.
You.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. We talked about Sayyid Nusrat Begum Amin, the author of Mahsan al-Irfan wal Tafsir al-Quran. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
www.parstoday.com/en What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.